Welcome to the November term of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. My name is David Arterburn. I am presiding at this session. I'm happy to be joined on my left by Judge Larry Welch of Plattsmouth, and by my right, on my right, Judge Mike Pirtle, or Chief Judge Mike Pirtle of Omaha. We are happy to be in Sarpy County today. As you know, we travel the state with arguments. Our other panel today is in Kearney. And so we are happy to be here in Papillion and are ready to begin. We do have five cases on for argument today. I would remind counsel that while these, since we are remote from our normal courtroom in Lincoln, we are not live streaming these arguments. These arguments are recorded and are available, will be available to the public. So if there's any sensitive information that you are talking about in your arguments, we certainly would like you to keep that in mind. So without any further delay, then we will call our first case. The first case is Lipe Chavez versus Lara Rojas. Counsel may approach counsel table, and counsel for the appellant may approach the podium. Again, this case is Lipe Chavez versus Lara Rojas. And Ms. Miller, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Samantha Miller. I'm attorney for the appellant, Mr. Ricardo Lipe Chavez. I'll reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay.
Mr. Ricardo Lipe Chavez respectfully asks this court to reverse the trial court's decision for legal and physical custody, parenting time, and child support, and the division of real estate. The October 8, 2021 decree, which is the subject of this appeal, dissolved the marriage of the appellant and the appellee. It divided the marital property and debts and decided issues of custody, parenting time, and child support for the party's minor child, their daughter. To my first point, to child support and child custody. While appellant understands the abuse of discretion standard is a high standard to meet, what we're asking that the court consider is the contradiction made by the trial court in awarding appellee sole legal and sole physical. The child lived with both parents for the first 4 years of her life. When they separated in March 2019, the court then went and had a temporary order entered that was entered in September of 2019. What's important for the court to understand is that the trial court determined that statute 43-2932 applied. This is the statute that states that if there is a finding of child abuse, child neglect of that nature, of violence, that the court must put limits on the parent and limit their parenting time to provide safety for the child or the other parent. That's what the court determined at the temporary order hearing and why the court determined that appellant should not have joint custody. At that time, the court awarded the mother sole legal and sole physical custody, giving the appellant Wednesday evenings, not even to overnight, and every other weekend. This was based on argument of counsel and affidavits. This was the status quo for parenting time for over 2 years, because this temporary order was entered in September of 2019 and trial was not until October of 2021.
Was there any effort to have the temporary order reviewed during that period of time?
There was no attempt to
You never filed a motion to have that reconsidered?
There was no motion because the courts are reluctant to award second temporary orders whilst the case is pending until trial. Okay. At trial, Judge Thompson of the trial court found appellee's allegations of abuse to lack specificity, that she failed to meet her burden that child abuse or domestic violence had occurred. What the court failed to do is consider how the limitation on parenting time given at that temporary hearing with the false abuse allegations impacted the relationship that the child and appellant had over the next several years. While the case was pending. This was over 2 years. Ultimately, the trial court found appellant to be less involved in the child's life. Appellant was reluctant to talk with appellee. But what the court failed to consider is that the domestic abuse allegations influenced his communications with appellee during that time. The court also briefly mentions concerns with appellee's living environment. This is a paramount that the courts consider in awarding custody and making their best interest determination. The trial court gave this little weight. However, the trial court briefly stated that there was concerns with the appellee's living environment, that she was allowing both of her two small children to sleep in the same bed with her, that she was living in a house with several people, didn't have space for her two children to have their own living space, that she was relying on her family members for financial support. The trial court mentions that this financial struggle came and that she was going to seek other education or seek other jobs, however, fails to mention the fact that she voluntarily quit her job. She had a good job at Children's Hospital, and she voluntarily quit that job. So the financial struggles was due to her own doing. So the fact that the trial court did not give both of those two things weight is why we believe there was an abuse of discretion in the custody award. To my second point, this also affected child support. Now this goes to my point that the appellee voluntarily quit her job, and the court makes reference to that she was earning $15.50 working full-time, voluntarily quit that job, was unemployed throughout the case and at the time of trial, was not seeking to regain that employment, yet put her at an earning capacity of $12 instead of $15.50. While he went on a long observation of the appellant's income and to put him at his highest earning capacity. Well, the same should have been afforded to the appellee. Also, this gets into the property division, but it also had an effect on child support because of the three rental properties that were divided. Now, the court took these rental properties and the income that the appellant was receiving and took that rental property income and configured it with his income for child support. However, he is now saying, the trial court is now ordering him to sell these properties. So if he's selling these properties, he's no longer going to have that rental income, yet he's
using... Can your client not buy the properties?
What was that?
Could your client not buy the properties?
Well, the trial court didn't even give him the option to refinance these houses. That's part of why we have appealed this case, and I'm getting it. Now, let's get into the property issues. Okay. So we do believe that there was an abuse of discretion in the division of just the real estate. So we're dealing with these three properties and the substantial non-marital nature and pre-marital nature that these properties have. Starting with the Florence Street property. This was purchased 4 years before the marriage in October of 2013. The appellant bought this with his brother. He put down over $40,000. While the court does give him back that $40,000, what the court failed to do was determine that there was significant premarital value from the time that this property was purchased until the parties separated in March of 2019. So what the court has done is he's awarding her 50% of this property. We find that to be very unfair and unreasonable to award her 50% of property that she had little to nothing to do with. That yes, they lived in it for 2 years during the marriage, but she was only contributing minor efforts. She was contributing, she says in her testimony, mowing the lawn, shoveling the driveway. That is not contributions that add to appreciation value.
This is the Florence property you're talking about?
This is the Florence property.
Right. Wasn't it split after the first $40,000?
Correct. Like I said, the court is going to give him an award of the first, to give him the first $40,000 off the proceeds of it.
And then split thereafter.
Yes. But what the issue
you're saying,
is...
You're saying the basis should have been higher. It should have been what the value of the property was as of the date of marriage, not as of the date of purchase, right?
For the Florence property, this property should be found as completely premarital property. The fact that this property has had little to nothing to do with the appellee, that she only lived there for a couple of years, but she wasn't even working during that time, so she wasn't providing any of her separate income to this. And this property was maintained and owned separately by the appellant several years before they even were married, and then after separation. So there was over 2 years between the time that they separated and the time that we went to trial. And during that time, it was, again, the appellant who was putting all of his money and efforts into this because he does roofing, he does construction.
Stop 2 minutes.
Okay. So into the last two properties, because the biggest issue was on the Florence due to the fact that that was purchased so much further before the marriage than the other properties.
So your position at trial was that it should have been totally a premarital property?
Correct.
And she should have had no interest in it?
Correct. Now, regarding the H Street property and the 20th Street property, those were bought a couple months after they were married. However, there was the evidence of the settlement, the HUD settlement statement, the property record, and the cashier's checks that were provided at court showing.
Now, on the settlement statements, her name was on one of those two statements.
Yes, her correct? Name was on one of those statements. However, what we show is that there was a significant amount of down payment for both of those houses. The court also fails to look at his income for those years. There's no way that this was marital income in the year of 2018 because he didn't make nearly as much as he put down in these houses, showing...
Well, didn't the evidence show that there was more money put down than what was in his account at the time they were married?
It was in the business account. He also testified that he had received money from his family members to pay for those properties. So it was money from the business account. That's ultimately where that money came from for the down payment of those houses. But the other thing that the trial court fails to consider is that these were rental properties that he was maintaining, that he was providing services to, that he was, you know, doing the roofing and contracting and flooring for. She had nothing to do with these properties. She wasn't going over and helping him maintain these properties.
Any income that comes in during the marriage is marital property, isn't it?
Correct, and the rental income is put into for purposes of child support. That's, you know, the rental income that he's receiving from
these. He was using this business account for both, for all purposes, in essence, wasn't he? Was he not?
I believe that he kept those separate.
He was
separate.
Paying personal bills out of it. He was, you know.
Well, the houses, the rental income that was coming from the two rental properties, because they were living in one of them. So there was rental income coming from two. And the rental income that was coming from those properties was used to merely the carrying costs of keeping those properties open. So they were paying for
themselves. Was there evidence of that? Did he testify? Was there any testimony to that regard?
He did testify to the fact that what the rental income was coming from those properties.
He testified to rental income?
Yeah.
Did he testify at all about what rental expenses he had?
I believe briefly he did. He did mention about what expenses were going towards those houses. No, I don't think it was elaborate testimony, though.
Okay, thank you.
I don't have anything further.
Anything else? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. How far did we take counsel over?
15 seconds.
Okay, would you add that to Mr. Vandenbosch's time?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you. Counsel, you may approach.
May it please the court? My name is Tony Vandenbosch, and I am the attorney for the appellee, Ms. Valeria Lara Rojas. The main points that we would like to make in our conversation or our presentation to the court today is the way that we review the cases, the way the appellate courts are looking at what the district court judge did. With reference to the custody issues, we feel that the court did a good job of reviewing the evidence, of making a determination based on a variety of factors, not ignoring the history that they had of the 4 years when they lived together, but also the court made references to the years prior to living together, the 4 years that they lived together, and then years subsequent. They made determinations based on who was the better parent and who was the better individual to have custody and control of the minor child. The court did make a note that it did not find any allegations of abuse and therefore did not use the analysis of abuse or potential abuse in its determination. What the court did is it looked at factors of who was more attentive to the child, who was involved in the child's life, what each individual said they would do in reference to problems, if the child had problems with school, if the child had problems with friends, if the child had problems, how they would communicate with each other was very apparently important to the court. Specifically, the court found that, we'll call him Ricardo, Mr. Lepez Chavez, specifically testified that he would not reach out to mom, that he would not communicate with her about problems that they would have had and could have with the minor child. The court also found that the attempts or efforts made by the father to gain more time or to fight for more time with his child was never attempted. Whether or not another temporary hearing would have been afforded, whether that would have changed anything is irrelevant. The point is Mr. Lepas did not try. He also did not ask for extra time on a voluntary basis from mom. It's also, there's testimony that he skipped or missed a few visits because he was either working or because of inclement weather. In the end, the court made an appropriate finding stating both that it did not believe that the parents would be able to co-parent and therefore was left with a choice of who would be the better parent to have custody. And at that point, the court deferred to the idea that Ms. Valeria Lara Rojas was the one most involved, was the one most capable, even though she had some financial problems, even though there was some question about whether or not she'd find appropriate housing. I think the court said that that was going to be temporary and that that could be something that would be overcome, but that the overall best interest of their daughter was that she have custody.
With regard to the financial, her financial situation, the record is pretty clear that she voluntarily gave up a position that was paying her $15.51 an hour. Is that fair?
That is correct, that she did give up that job. I believe during that time she had a very close family member. If I recall correctly, her grandmother had passed away. Now, this is a non-nuclear family where multiple generations are very close, and so the loss of a grandparent is akin to a loss of a parent, and she took some time off work for that. She did testify that she was looking for more jobs, and that leads me into the next segue, which is the calculation of child support. I think the court...
And that's the question I was going to have for you is given that she was making $15.50, why is it that the district court found her monthly income, and she wasn't working at the time, to only be in the $12 range when it was clear she had and possibly could find another position that paid her the same kind of money?
I think at that point the judge took into consideration all the previous income that she had had before, her current attempts to find a job, and had to make an assessment based on what her potential was. The lack of a current job at the time of trial is the same for the lack of a current income that Mr. Lepas couldn't say he was making. That forced the court to make an analysis of what their potential was. And so I think the court, rather than say you automatically can get your job back, for sure you can get a $15 position, especially that was during COVID or right after COVID, I think they made their best assessment as to what her potential was. Likewise, the court made its best attempt to calculate what Mr. Lepas's income would be.
And that was on the high end, wasn't it?
It was not as high as what we had calculated as we had asked for about $1,000 more, and I think $8,800, and they calculated him at $7,800 a month. The court didn't specifically find whether or not they included the income from rentals. The court just took an average or calculated an average based on the evidence presented. Keep in mind that at that point, Ricardo Lepas Chavez did not present any evidence or give any credible testimony as to what he was earning at the time. He said he didn't know. He said he wasn't aware. It wasn't that his accountant presented evidence saying he was making less. It was that he failed to give any evidence beyond his taxes for 16, 17, and 18. The court took those numbers and estimated what his earning potential could be based on the up-and-coming growing company that he had.
Counsel made the point that rental income was included in assessing Ricardo's income for purposes of child support. If we were to conclude that income was included, is it a problem that the court then ordered the properties sold and split?
I don't believe so, because the moment that the property is split, the court found that Mr. Lepez had the same capacity to go out and buy other properties with the money, once those properties are sold, the money that he could use to recreate the success that he was having. Also, I think the court was basing more of the calculation, assuming that the child support was calculated, they deducted $1,000 from his income to make up for any loss in income from rental companies. So I think the calculation that they came up with was correct because it took into consideration what he could make from his business plus what he could make should he take that money that he got from selling his properties and buy one rental property.
All,
and that's why he didn't...
All the money? Meaning if he sold the properties or half of the money because she gets half.
Well, the 50% that would go to him would be all of his money. So I was, when I said all the money, I was calculating all the money that would be his share.
Okay.
So the 40,000 plus the half of the three properties that would be sold, he could easily buy one or two more properties, and that's why they didn't take into consideration the full amount we were asking for.
Let's go to the 40,000 if we can. How do you respond to Ms. Miller's argument that at minimum, the court should have been looking at what the value of the Florence Street house was at the time? I mean, I know their position is that all of it should be his as non-marital property, but with respect at minimum, the non-marital value should be set as of the date of the marriage instead of as of the date of the purchase. How do you respond to that?
Our response would be twofold. One, in a de novo review, we're looking whether or not the trial court made an error, an obvious error, or a misjudgment or a miscalculation. Here, the court took the evidence that it had, how much the value was at purchase, how much was given by Mr. Lepez as initial down payment, and then had to make an assessment of those values. There's no evidence that shows what the value was at the marriage and what the equity was level at that.
Well, wasn't there evidence of the assessed value at least roughly the time of the marriage?
There was evidence of the assessed value at the time of the marriage and also at the time of the separation. The court found that both of those estimates or both of those numbers were not profound enough, not believable enough, not accurate enough to use as an accurate measurement for either of those values. And the lack of further value, either in appraisal or other testimony, the court deferred to the idea that the most equitable solution would be to sell it at market value and then divide those properties at that such. Keep in mind that the court had to address their burden to prove that it was non-marital property. And so it did the analysis by saying, we have a property that starts out as non-marital, but then through commingling of funds, co-use of income, and the idea that both testified that they worked on the property, lived at the property with the intention of making it their home. I'm specifically talking about the Florence property at that point. They found that because of the commingling and the parties' effects or efforts on the properties, that it was at that point marital property. And I think the court did a good job of deciding that because both parties and both efforts were used in the increase of the value of the property, plus income, which is obviously a marital property, was used in the maintenance of the home and the remodeling of the home. So everything that the parties were making financially was being used to improve the value of this home. Likewise, with the other two properties, we start with a crux, or the main point is that they're saying it's not marital property because the funds used were from the business account. Keep in mind that at trial, they're...
Sir, you've about run your time here, okay. So
I don't have anything.
Do you have any other questions?
I don't.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Van den Bosch. And I believe Ms. Miller used all of her time after all, so. All right. The case will be deemed submitted. And we'll issue a decision as soon as we can. The parties are excused. All right, the next case is, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing Bucer versus Bucer?